I'd like to call into session here the March 26, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning to everyone. I am pleased to see that we have two generals with us this morning, Generals Caldwell and Doctor. Welcome to both of you. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3256, and I'd like to open this up, please, with Representatives Matthews and Freeman, if you'd please come forward. I think this is the first time that both of you have testified before our subcommittee this year.
We've been welcome.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm state representative with House District 50, which is Gresham. Proud to be here before your committee, and thanks very much for this opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3256. This came about as kind of several conversations with folks that are very concerned about our veterans, and given the fact that we're facing a deployment of 3,000 troops in early May. Those troops, as you know, are citizen soldiers that are basically leaving occupations now to go defend our country and our great nation. And our concern is that currently there is federal law in the USERRA that is, of course, the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act of 1994. But there's really no teeth at the state level to make sure that these folks are protected when they come home and that their jobs are still available. So the Reemployment Rights Act is really something that was kind of near and dear to my heart, realizing that, of course, you know, employers will have to replace that workforce while they're gone on deployment for 18 to 20 months, but they have to be in position to bring those folks back to work when they return home. And so this was a matter of getting down, of course, with some folks from the military, which, of course, you mentioned the generals are here. We also have the employer support of the Guard and Reserve here as well. General Doctor may speak to them, to their cause. Very proud that this is a bipartisan legislation effort, and this comes down to really trying to get a statute in place for Oregon that will allow the Attorney General to enforce the cases where people are being discriminated against for their service in the National Guard Army Reserves. You'll hear testimony today of a couple different cases where folks have been overlooked for potential promotion. You'll probably hear, I think, the good representative to my right here will talk about a case where they almost missed out on an exceptional individual for leadership simply because he was part of the Guard. So it's not just about our returning soldiers, but it's also the soldiers that are citizen soldiers that might be missing out on opportunities or perhaps being overlooked simply because they've made a commitment to their country. And so that's really the basis of the bill, and this really will do that. The proposal will be to amend 659A, which is the ORS, and it's an unlawful employment discrimination. I'm going to allow the DOJ to talk specifically about that. I just wanted to give you the content and the context of our conversations that this is really about how do we protect the positions of our veterans so when they leave, they know they're coming home back to the jobs that they left. And that's why we bring this before this committee.
Thank you very, very much.
Good morning, everybody. Chair Witt and the honorable members of the Subcommittee on Workforce Development, for the record, I am Tim Freeman, State Representative for House District 2. And it's amazing that we even have to bring this bill forward. I was surprised that it didn't already happen. I do believe it's important that we have a state support system that offers protection for our guards and reservists. Regardless of whether this discrimination is currently happening, we owe it to our servicemen and women to make sure that it never happens. We owe them the assurance that their employment and reemployment rights will be upheld. Unnecessary pressure should not be placed on them, their families, or their employers, and I'll get back to why I included employers, because of their choice to serve and protect our country. This is an opportunity for us to offer them reassurance that they have the same freedoms and opportunities they so selfishly defend. I want to tell you a little bit about a process I went through what seems like a lifetime ago, back when I was the council president at the city of Roseburg. Myself and the mayor and the group of city councilors went through the process of hiring a new city manager. We got down to the three finalists, and one of those was an Air National Guard member. And we had several people around the table that made comments to the effect, well, we can't hire this person because he may be deployed and we wouldn't have a city manager while he was deployed. And that was incredibly troubling to me. And without the clarity that this law would provide, that just came out like it was a discrimination they would say about other people in other situations. I did have, luckily, the support from other counselors to say, wait a minute, this is exactly the type of person we want to lead our city, somebody that's committed to his country at the level that this man was, and we did eventually hire this city manager. He did serve a tour in Iraq, and when he came back, he was incredibly valuable to our community, having the knowledge and the experience of having served overseas. So I think it's really important that we look for ways to keep those type of conversations from happening, and not happen in a closed room where you wouldn't necessarily have press or know what was going on, but I'm afraid it may happen more than we know. So this should help with that. I want to thank the chair and the committee members for your time, and I urge your support of House Bill 3256.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Appreciate your bringing this bill forward, a critically important bill. Certainly appreciate your presence here and your testimony. Any quick questions for or comments for our colleagues before we let them go for their other business today? Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, gentlemen. Again, echoing what Chair Witt just said. And I think we're well into it. I mean, it's not as though it happened a year or two ago. We're a number of years into this situation now, but our guardsmen are being used in a much different way than they historically were. And so that puts us in a situation where maybe we do need to educate employers to the new twist that we all have to deal with. And until the feds determine that it's appropriate maybe to go back to having a larger strength regular army or whatever that picture might take on, if it ever happens, until then, the only solution is to take up the gap with Guard and Reserve. And I was very privileged to have traveled with the Guard before the term embedding became popular as a reporter and general doctor. And I have had a glass of wine at the Intercontinental Hotel in Vienna, Austria before, and got acquainted with he and many of the Army and Air Guard troops that were over there. In that particular day, we visited Kachina Air Base in Slovakia, and the Air Guard out of Klamath Falls was there. They had been doing a training at the Air Tower Control Tower. It had been a Soviet air base for a number of years, and the U.S. had committed to go in there and assist them in getting their economy built up, and they were going to use this air base for commercial use. And their air tower control operators had to be educated in how to bring in, you know, modern jets and whatnot. And so it was quite an experience for me to be over there with them and watch the training and see what the Guards people do overseas in a number of different situations. That was just one trip and one instance. But I do think this is an important bill to educate employers, the public, about our commitment to our military. Thank you.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that.
Please.
Representative Huffman, I appreciate your comments, and you're exactly right. They're being utilized in ways that we never anticipated, you know, years ago. And a lot of these men and women have dedicated a great deal of their life, not only once or twice, but sometimes now their third deployment. I continue to say they're making choices, and their families make the sacrifice. There are a number of bills that I would like to push through, given that today's economic times we're not going to be able to. One of those is differential pay, which I'm proud to say the city of Gresham does that for our soldiers, but I understand that most organizations couldn't do that. But the reality is that a lot of these folks are taking quite a cut in pay when they go on deployment, and they're coming into a different set of circumstances, and so the more we can do to protect them. But I do want to say that the good news is, and I'm sure you'll hear from the employer support of the Guard and Reserve, that there is an educational component that's out there now working with employees and these servicemen and women to let them know and educate them on USARA and what the law is and what the law does. It's just that it doesn't reach far enough, and there's not an enforcement enforcing tool within the state level. So this is really an effort that we kind of all work together again. And understanding, of course, that, you know, in years past, employers used to kind of, they look at the guard as, well, it's a week in a month and a couple weeks out of the year. I guess we'll get by on that. And it's turning into so much more for our soldiers now. And I think, you know, in today's world, we understand that it could be 18 to 20-month deployment for these soldiers. And getting the employers to feel comfortable with the fact that it's the right thing to do. I know they get attached to these folks after 18 months on the replacement end of it, but they should really be honest with these folks and tell them they're hiring them as a temporary position, because that job belongs to the soldiers that left it to go serve the country.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, I'm a little bit involved in this as well, being on the Veterans Committee as well. But more importantly, I run this by my chamber liaison, and they like the bill. So business itself, at least in my area, supports what we're doing with this particular bill. So thanks for bringing this forward, gentlemen. I appreciate it very much, and I know that our people in uniform will.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel, thanks for joining us on the mission, if you will. But also, I think that this allows the business, actually, it kind of gives them what they kind of need, too, to make sure that they're informing people to say, now they're bound by not only a federal, but they could be bound by the state, and they won't want to face those penalties or consequences either, and I'll let DOJ get more into that. But thank you for your comments, Representative Esquivel. Appreciate your support.
Representative Dembrow.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to say, you know, the one positive thing, if we can call it that, of your experience, Representative Freeman, was that the people involved with you on your committee, on your council, overtly expressed that, you know, discrimination, right? You know, I think in many circumstances, people will have those thoughts, and they'll base those decisions on their decisions on those thoughts, but won't articulate except maybe in private afterwards. Right. So they can't be addressed, and that's why, you know, I think just the consciousness raising aspect of this is so important, because many of these this kind of prejudice is very subtle and hard to pin down.
Correct. Additional questions or comments for our colleagues? Representative Matthews and Freeman, thank you again very, very much for your appearance and for bringing this bill forward. Critically important.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you very much, committee members.
Before we call on any witnesses, and gentlemen, feel free to stay. We recognize that you've got other business in the building, so we wanted to be able to get you out of here as soon as possible. Thank you. Kevin, if you would give us a summary of the bill here.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I will be brief. I understand that the Attorney General's office has provided a representative who will put a lot more flesh on the bone, so to speak. Before you is House Bill 3256, which provides is an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate against a person because of the person's service in the uniform service. It defines when discrimination takes place in terms if you're an employer, if the employer is a public body, denying the public official or employee the status or rights provided by ORS Chapter 408 related to advantages given to veterans in public employment. Number two, denying a person initial employment, reemployment following leave taken for service in a uniform service, retention of employment, promotion, or any other term of condition of employment because of a person applies, performs, or has performed in a uniform service. Or three, discharges, expelling, disciplining, or taking other action, retaliating against a person for exercising or attempting to exercise rights to participate in the uniform service. There is also before you a -1 amendment that we received late yesterday afternoon that also modifies the bill, in terms of providing the Attorney General and the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries the ability to file a complaint in either Circuit Court in Marion County or the Circuit Court in which the particular discrimination occurs. It also provides remedies that may be sought, including recovery of sums, damages rather, incurred by the person, as well as attorney fees and potentially injunctive relief. And finally, if it results in a pattern or there's a pattern of discrimination that occurs, there are civil penalties to the tune of $50,000 for the first finding of a pattern of or practice of discrimination, and $100,000 for a subsequent finding of a practice or pattern of discrimination.
Thank you very much.
for our witnesses here, I'd like to call up first, please, General Mike Caldwell and General Bill Doctor. Did you want to testify, General? I noticed that you weren't signed up, but we'd like to afford you.
Okay, I can chat about ESGR if you like and what we do.
Sir, that would, I think that would be very helpful for us. Thank you very much.
This is the GLJ first.
And this is Mr. Kramer?
Yes,
okay. Please, if you would.
Can I bring this water up?
Absolutely, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Kramer. I'm from the Oregon Department of Justice. The generals, as they are wont to do, ask the colonel to lead off. After several decades in the Air Force, I respond to those cues very well. So, with your permission, I will do that.
Please.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name is David Kramer. I'm the attorney in charge of the Employment Litigation Section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also a retired U.S. Air Force Reserve Colonel with some 24 years' experience as a judge advocate, much of which was at the Air Force Reserve installation in Portland, which is now closed. At Representative Matthews' request, Attorney General John Kroger has asked that I testify today, and I'm very happy to do so. House Bill 3256 is a result of Attorney General Kroger's and Representative Matthews' broader effort to help Oregon veterans. In the case of House Bill 3256, the fundamental concept is to help veterans, guardsmen, and reservists keep their civilian jobs or to compete equally for civilian jobs without being penalized by their military service to state and country. The bill results from several historical circumstances, each of which I will address briefly. Afterwards, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions you or, for that matter, the generals have. First, I note, as you already know, there are several people here today with close ties to the military, and I don't know that any of them have signed up to testify, but I do know that they're all here in support and would be happy to ask any questions. In particular, other than the folks you already introduced, Mr. Chairman, Colonel Bob Elliott is here with and he is very, very knowledgeable about what happens on the ground in these cases. The circumstances and assumptions that give rise to House Bill 3256 include the following. First, the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan obviously put tremendous pressures on members of the Guard and Reserve Forces, their families, and their employers. These pressures invariably impact a service person's ability to get and keep a civilian job and an employer's incentive to hire and retain citizen soldiers. Two, the current system for protecting employment rights of citizen soldiers is managed largely by the federal government. While our federal partners do an outstanding job resolving employment issues, usually on an informal basis, statistics and experience suggest that our partners could use some help. Our Oregon veterans could benefit from protections based on state law, which would be enforceable in state courts. Three, existing state law prohibits employment discrimination against various classes of workers. There is no Oregon statute that extends comparable protections to veterans and citizen soldiers who are employed in the private sector. Four, the Oregon Attorney General and the Oregon Circuit Courts currently have little, if any, statutory authority to help Oregonians who face workplace discrimination as a result of their military service. Attorney General Kroger is eager to obtain the clear legal authority necessary for him and his successors to help these patriots. He also believes that Oregon Circuit Courts, like the federal courts, are fully capable of adjudicating veterans' disputes when informal resolution does not work. Indeed, our state courts may well be more accessible to veterans geographically and financially compared to the federal system. Now let me address each of these points in a bit more detail. First, with respect to the increased pressures, I know the subcommittee is well aware of these various societal pressures that have occurred since the United States found itself fighting two wars and a recession at the same time. And I'll not take your time to discuss the obvious. Suffice it to say that the pressures are enormous upon any given reservist or guardsman who is increasingly absent for training and deployment and who finds him or herself competing to get or keep civilian jobs. In fairness, the pressure is also on patriotic employers who necessarily have bottom-line financial concerns that result from supporting our troops. Agencies dealing with veterans issues seem to agree that most employers are patriotic and work hard to support our troops. To the extent that senior management of such employers learn of a veteran's employment-related problem, generally they tend to find an acceptable accommodation and use that experience to educate subordinate managers regarding their legal and social obligations. This partially explains, I think, the great success of existing programs like the United States Department of Defense's Employer Support for the Guard and Reserve Program, called ESGR, and the Department of Labor's Veterans Employment and Training Service, called VETS. However, discrimination does occur, and it will always occur. These economic pressures create a powerful disincentive for certain employers to hire or retain citizen soldiers. When intentional discrimination occurs, when a company puts profit over patriotism, the soldier, victim, and his family typically face a protracted uphill legal battle and virtually no income to sustain them. In those cases, I would add, where the mediation process does not work. And the simple truth is, as suggested earlier, is that it can be very difficult to prove discrimination. The proof is often circumstantial. Disingenuous employers may camouflage workplace discrimination with the same rhetoric protected class members have heard since before anti-discrimination laws were first considered. For instance, historically speaking, discrimination victims hear offending employers use terms like downsizing or reorganization to explain the loss of a job and camouflage a true intent to discriminate. Worse, victims might be accused of feigned performance or conduct charges. Proving the truth or falsity of such allegations can be daunting. Meanwhile, discrimination victims, to include returning veterans, can expect to be out of work and financially vulnerable for extended periods of time, while the federal government's predominantly voluntary process gives way to the federal administrative process, which in turn may give way to a federal lawsuit brought by the United States Department of Justice. Few veterans can afford to stay that course. Few private attorneys have the expertise, time, or financial incentive to maintain a federal discrimination lawsuit in federal court under these circumstances. Fewer still are the attorneys and clients who are in a position to seek preliminary injunctions or restraining orders that might protect a service member's job while the legal process unfolds. In this environment, it makes sense to have better legal tools to protect service members and to give them more access to our state court system. It also makes sense that the Attorney General, with the resources of his or her office, have the option to enforce anti-discrimination laws in the appropriate cases and to do so in a manner that results in timely relief for our veterans. For the most part, only federal statutes and federally supported programs protect military members from employment discrimination. The principal anti-discrimination statute is the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act of 1994, called USERRA. USERRA creates civilian employment rights for service members and veterans, among other things, and under certain conditions. USERRA requires employers to put individuals back to work in their civilian jobs after performing military service. USERRA also protects service members from discrimination in the workplace based on their military service or affiliation. In general terms, USERRA offers federal protection to guardsmen and reservists who are voluntarily or involuntarily recalled to active duty. It requires employers, regardless of size, to reemploy returning veterans on the terms they would have otherwise enjoyed but for their military duty, which is called escalator theory. USERRA provides a private federal right of action. However, if the service member hires private counsel and does not cooperate with federal authorities, and I think by definition that includes filing your own action, the federal authorities dismiss their case. USERRA cannot be enforced in state courts except in those cases where the state of Oregon itself is the defendant. The federal process for dealing with the alleged USERRA violations is primarily administrative in nature and handled by the two federal agencies I mentioned. Among other things, VETS attempts to solve USERRA problems through its mediation program. Unresolved complaints are referred to the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division for possible enforcement action. The Department of Defense also has a program to help solve USERRA programs. As the name implies, the National Committee for Employer Support for the Guard and Reserve Program, or ESGR, is focused on employers. It emphasizes employer education and incentives for supporting Guard and Reservists. Among other activities, ESGR has a nationwide network of volunteer mediators who handle USERRA complaints. Complaints that are not withdrawn or resolved through mediation are referred back to the Department of Labor's VETS program and start through their process. What are the results of the federal process? According to the USERRA fiscal year 2006 annual report to Congress, the Department of Labor reviewed some 1,357 formal USERRA complaints for fiscal year 2006. Of those reports, 414 were resolved in favor of the veteran. Depending on which data in the report one focuses on, either 93 or 81 cases were referred to the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Section. USDOJ in turn reports that it handled, without explanation, 75 of those cases through its national office and referred six cases, to U.S. Attorney's offices for civil prosecution. The SGR program reports that over the course of a year on a national basis, it assigned some 2,664 cases to its volunteers and mediated some 1,899 complaints. Of those, if I'm reading the data correctly, and we have people here who can correct me if I'm wrong, approximately 715 of those were filed or come from Oregon, and 22 were assigned for resolution, and 14 of the complaints were mediated. Accordingly, it seems to me, employers know that very few contested cases are ever referred to the U.S. attorney, and still fewer are civilly prosecuted. They also know there is a little enforcement activity by state's attorneys general. And as far as I can tell, the exceptions would include places like Minnesota, Louisiana, New Hampshire, Florida, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, a relatively few number of states that have adopted USERRA-like statutes. Finally, and I think this is important, in Oregon there is no active duty military presence, which might otherwise provide related support services like legal services to the member, political influence of just being in the state, or any kind of informal intervention. These circumstances may well contribute to what I gather is a growing frustration among returning Guard and Reservists who experience problems getting and keeping a job. The fundamental concept of HB 3256 is to extend to citizen soldiers and veterans the same level of protection Oregon statutes currently provide to other protected class members, and to open the state court system to military victims. In doing so, it would follow the lead of the other states mentioned above. Under existing state statute, employment discrimination and retaliation is prohibited in a variety of circumstances relating to the status of the victim. For example, protections extend to public employee whistleblowers, to witnesses who testify before the legislature, to injured workers, to disabled persons. This, of course, is in addition to the protections afforded to members of traditional protected classes, like those folks in the protected classes of race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, and age. Oregon has two statutes which arguably are similar to USERRA, but they do not protect all Oregonians who serve in the military. ORS 408.240 provides reemployment rights, but only for service members who are public employees. The difficulties with this statute are, one, it applies to public officers and employees only. Two, it has no enforcement mechanism or right of action. And three, the statute does not provide the Attorney General explicit authority to enforce it. ORS 399.230 is a statute that provides certain reemployment rights for members of the National Guard performing duty in their state capacities. For example, the traditional role as a firefighter or helping out in the town that's under stress. But as I read it, it does not protect reservists and does not protect members of the Guard who are put into federal service. As proposed, HB 3256 would fill these gaps that now exist and give service members the same protections afforded to other protected class members. As we discussed earlier, Oregon service persons must rely almost exclusively upon the federal law, federal law enforcers, and their partners here in the state of Oregon, I would add. USERRA gives standing to the United States Attorney General to bring cases under federal law, but not to states' attorney general. This is particularly problematic on a very practical level. Proving discrimination when it exists can be difficult. It usually requires circumstantial evidence found through painstaking discovery processes. It may require the investigation of multiple comparator cases looking for evidence of an illegal pattern. The involved service member, almost by definition, will be out of work and out of money, making it difficult to hire private counsel even under the best of circumstances. Attorney General John Kroger wants the legal tools to help these patriots. He is confident that Oregon state courts are fully capable of adjudicating disputes when informal resolution does not work. However, the extent of the Attorney General's authority in this arena is unclear. There is at least some statutory authority for his office to enforce anti-discrimination laws found at ORS 659A825 and 659A874C. Still, these statutes must be changed if the Attorney General is to help protect veterans and other victims of workplace discrimination. And, Mr. Chair, I would note that this discussion primarily involves a Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you.
For instance, ORS 659A825-1 allows the Attorney General to file a complaint if he has reason to believe that any person has committed an unlawful discriminatory practice. However, a complaint in this instance seems to be limited to the filing of an administrative complaint with Bowling. ORS 659A820 is the statute at issue there. If the Attorney General files a BOLI complaint under ORS 659A825, the Attorney General may elect to have the matter heard in circuit court by virtue of 659A874C, but there is no further discussion in the statute as to when or under what circumstances the Attorney General may file such a complaint to enforce employment discrimination, or, in my opinion, more importantly, what remedies are available to the Attorney General on behalf of the person. This kind of ambiguity deters enforcement action and makes such actions more susceptible to legal challenge. The ambiguous nature of the Attorney General's enforcement role in this arena is also evident with respect to housing discrimination law. I have, in my written testimony, a discussion about ORS 659A8857, which I include for comparison purposes, but I'll defer going through the details of that. Suffice it to say there are two problems with that particular example. The Attorney General is limited to cases where there are multiple victims, and there are only limited circumstances where attorney's fees are available. The point we're trying to make here, to me, is simply that the Attorney General's authority seems to have evolved from a patchwork of different statutes, and the proposal, at least in the Dash 1 amendment, is to try to put a comprehensive bow tie around that so that it's clear the Attorney General has standing to help victims, including military victims, of employment discrimination. As a policy matter, it seems the Attorney General should have wide discretion to file actions to enforce state anti-discrimination laws. A pending amendment to HB 3256, the Dash 1 amendment, would further amend ORS 659A825-1 to clarify and broaden the scope of the Attorney General's authority. Conceptually, this proposal would give the AG the authority to file an action to stop all unlawful practices as defined in the statute, allow the action to be brought in the name of the state of Oregon and against private persons and entities, allow the state to recover as restitution damages individuals could otherwise have recovered for themselves had they had the means to bring the action, provide for injunctive relief to stop the unlawful action and prevent its reoccurrence, and provide for civil penalties under the same terms and amounts as currently provided for housing discrimination. The specific proposed language to clarify the Attorney General's authority is in my written testimony, and I'll not read it in the record unless you think that would be helpful to you, Mr. Chairman. But it is in the Dash 1 amendment, I believe.
Thank you.
In conclusion, Mr. Chair, while state and federal statutes give veterans, guardsmen, and reservists certain reemployment rights, the legal support system has gaps that prevent a more comprehensive partnership between state and federal authorities to enforce those rights. And these gaps further prevent victims from seeking remedies in state courts. I believe Attorney General Kroger believes that the legislature can fill these gaps by passing legislation like that proposed in HB 3256. That concludes my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman, and I'm available for questions, but the generals are here as well, and the colonel probably ought to defer to them.
Thank you very, very much, Colonel Kramer, for an extremely detailed background on the subtle and sometimes not so subtle discrimination that our service members potentially face in terms of employment discrimination. That was excellent background and grounding. Subcommittee members, not to keep the generals waiting, but this, I suspect their legal analysis will not be quite as in depth, and I don't know if anyone has any legal questions before we move on to the two generals' presentation.
Mr. Chair, yes. that's why generals have colonels.
That's right. Representative Dumbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not exactly a legal question. It's more a sort of workload question. I've heard the Attorney General talk about the need to beef up the Civil Rights Division within his office. And so, is your sense that the office has the capacity to really be aggressive in this area?
Representative Dumbrough, I think there are 300 lawyers or so, something like that, at the Department of Justice. I think it's a question that of resources and how to use the resources. I know from public statements that Attorney General Kroger is well aware of the fiscal limitations that are pending, but I also know from public statements that he is very serious about becoming more aggressive in certain areas, including this one. I have not had any discussion with him on what the master plan is, but he's made it clear that at least myself and several other people ought to stand by.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your in-depth testimony, but it does give rise to, I think, a particular question for me, and I'm just sort of wondering, and I know there's a representative from Boley here, but not the commissioner. I'm just wondering whether the actions that the Attorney General's office is seeking are duplicate of what powers the Commissioner Boley already has, or is this a complementary, proposal that you're able to pick up where the Commissioner is not able to take care of these issues? Because traditionally, I think in our statutes, this sort of discrimination and employment issues have been handled through the Bureau of Labor and Industries through their employment attorneys and discrimination attorneys. So I'm hesitant, I guess, to have two agencies doing the same thing. I guess is I just want to make sure that we're, as the state, doing this efficiently.
Right. Well, it's a good question, Representative Holvey. The reality is that right now, with respect to all anti-discrimination statutes, there is a statutory partnership between Boley and the Attorney General. So what we're suggesting here is to extend that partnership to cases involving veterans. Right now, any other protected class member, any other people who are suffering from some of the kinds of discrimination I discussed that don't relate to veterans, they have a process to go to Boley, which works in partnership with federal authorities, and then Boley has the administrative responsibilities to investigate and take certain actions. What we're suggesting here is that partnership be extended to veterans, mm-hmm. and that same existing structure be applied to them. So it's not a new concept by any stretch, and it's not one that, at least in my experience in defending the state and many other kinds of employment discrimination matters, is duplicative. It, essentially what happens as a practical matter is you have a new and significant tool in the toolbox, and by virtue of having that tool, it tends to make the people who are working informally to try to solve problems, or the people who are working administratively to solve problems, more eager to solve the problem because there's another player in town who, if he or she is not satisfied, can devote resources to it. Also, I would suggest that there are certain times when I could easily envision the commissioner and the attorney general having a discussion about a given case or type of case and having some informal agreement as to who is the better resource to take on a given problem. And that would be completely fact-specific. But I guess the punchline would be, I think there's a real active partnership there, and this is an idea that would just extend the partnership to one more area of employment discrimination. Does that help?
Yeah. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it does. I appreciate that comment. I just, you know, I am not against, as a matter of fact, I'm quite in favor of multi-agency cooperation. I just want to make sure that it's, you know, done so with efficiency in mind so that we don't have two agencies doing the same thing, not cooperating. I guess that's my concern.
My experience is that kind of cooperation is active and it's almost a prerequisite because nobody has, as you well know, the resources to do everything they want to do. So people do have to come to yes in terms of what to do, who's going to do it, and how it should be done.
Thank you.
Representative Dimbro?
No, I was just going to say, as we're having this conversation, I remember when the Attorney General was running for office, one of his promises was that he would move the department into the area of really aggressive enforcement, working with BOLI to aggressively enforce discrimination cases at the workplace. And, you know, it's good to hear that he's sticking to that promise.
Dave, I know you mentioned that I think there were 700-plus cases here where various individuals were aggrieved in the state of Oregon. Just curious over what period of time that occurred, if you know.
I'm going to, if it's all right with the chair, probably punt to one of the generals or perhaps Colonel Elliott, who's in the audience. But my understanding from reading their materials is that was for a one-year period of time.
That's a roll-up.
I
going all the
way
back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And we had 117 inquiries/issues last year, 21 of which became issues, if you will. The other were inquiries, and I'll just add that we get a lot of phone calls that will ask us a question about you, Sarah, and the issue is resolved right on the spot. And the employer typically says, thank you for straightening me out. So Oregon, I think, does a really fine job at taking care of the soldiers of the state of Oregon. 21 of those cases, 17 we in fact mediated the SGR, and then 4 we turned over to the Department of Labor Vets for their work.
Thank you very much, General Doctor, and that actually helps to make the point that I want to do. The 700-plus cases are very compelling, and Representative Matthews, we intend to get this bill out of this committee here today because of that. But I also don't want us to lose sight of the fact that that roll-up includes literally thousands, probably tens of thousands of Oregon's military personnel who have returned in probably the majority of cases repeatedly without problems. And the point that I'm trying to make is most employers, the vast extent of the time, are doing the right thing, are doing the good job, are accommodating our military personnel and supporting the military families and this country's efforts. But we need a fix. There are some folks that don't just quite get it right the first time, and we're going to assist them here today in making sure that they do get it right. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the two generals, and Mike and Bill, you guys can decide who goes first.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. We're delighted to be here today in support of House Bill 3256. I want to thank Attorney General Kroger, his staff, and Representative Matthews and Freeman for pulling this together to get it before you. I think you've heard the testimony from Colonel Kramer, and I think he did a great job of explaining what this bill will and won't do. Just a couple of highlights that I want to reemphasize. I think you've got to hit it right on the head with the most of the discrimination that I see come to us and end up bypassing along to employer support of the Guard and Reserve folks is it's a subtle type of discrimination. It's certainly not an overt and outright. It's very hard to identify, hard to define, and hard to get your fingers around. And believe it or not, most of the ones that I see are not private employers. I'll be real candid with you. Most of the problems that I have witnessed have been public employers at every level. So I think what's going to happen with this bill is perhaps maybe not a lot of court actions will take place, but I think it will cause public employers in the state of Oregon to really take notice and give us an opportunity to further educate the public employment realm that these types of activities are not only illegal, but they will be punished. I think my objective would be to see compliance. Punishment certainly is rare. I can think of three cases that I'm aware of since the war started. Two of those three were public employers. They made the newspaper, the one in Sherwood, the one in Southern Oregon, made lots of headlines on both of them, and they were egregious. I mean, they just simply should have never happened. And there was efforts made by the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve to work with those public employers, one a school district, one a city, to try to resolve those, and it couldn't be resolved. And so they ended up going into a lawsuit. And I think that's fairly standard. The legislature in 2005, right after the war began, and we started deploying numerous amounts of people, a retired state policeman came up to me who used to do the lobby work down here for the state police, and he told me about his problem over he'd moved to Central Oregon. He said, you know, I have all the certifications. I can be a police officer. I am a police officer. Police officers were deployed out of a small city in Central Oregon, police force of about 14 or 15 people. Put a tremendous burden on the local chief of police in that community. He could only work 6 months before his PERS. He was punished for his PERS. And he said, you know, I have no reason to stay and hold that job, and I know what's going to happen. The minute these guys get back, this chief's going to have to send people through DPSSD, fill those slots. It isn't like going and hiring somebody off the street or a fireman or anybody else. You've got to get them trained, and then this guy's going to be back in 12 or 18 months. And he said, I'd be more than happy to work the 12 or 18 months and then go right back to retirement. But he said, I'd be glad to leave, but he said, I can't, so I got to quit at 6. So we asked the legislature if they would extend the privilege for retirees to when they backfill a PERS reservist or guardsman, that there's no harm, no foul. Legislature thought that was a good idea. They liked the idea. They passed it. And we see that working very, very nicely, particularly in smaller communities where they have that limited bench. Unfortunately, we still have trouble getting that word out. It's an education process. We continue to educate. We continue to tell our soldiers that. We continue to tell, you know, the different lobby groups, the different associations that this is available to them. We've had numerous stories of wonderful workarounds where that's really paid dividends. A chief of police in Pendleton called me one day, and he was very upset. He had three guys deploying with the 3116 out of Eastern Oregon. He said, I just don't know what I'm going to do. And I told him about this law, and he said, really? And I said, in fact, because I know two of your former retirees, because one of them was my driver in my tank. And he said, yeah, I know him. And he went and he said, called him, and next thing you know, he had him back to work. So the legislature has taken steps over the last several years to try to find these little leeches, fix them, and try to make things easier. So I think this is another step, a big step, and I really believe that it's going to add more education, more opportunity for people to get smart as opposed to, you know, fight the bid, if you will. And we've seen a lot of that, and it's really been amazing to me. The people who fight the bid the hardest are the public employers, not the private ones. Private ones typically want to come to a resolution, get it resolved, and move forward. They don't want the problem, they don't want to fight it, and they want to play ball. with a few exceptions, but most generally that's been the case.
Mike, if I could interrupt just for a minute. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. General, it wasn't the private-public employer that I'm keying off of, but as you were talking about things that the legislature is doing, and I don't know if you or if Representative Matthews or Representative Esquivel can maybe address this, but I was sitting here thinking of acquaintances that I've had that have come back from Iraq or Afghanistan, and we just were visiting in a meeting not too long ago, and I'm thinking that there's a piece of legislation out there that will allow some buffer time for vets coming back so that, you know, 2 weeks after hitting U.S. soil, they're not having to step in and perform their old job again because of, you know, the trauma they've gone through. So often they're not in that job 3 months down the road because they just couldn't, and not even in their marriage oftentimes because they just didn't have that buffer time to ease back into society. How does that play a role in this? Is there going to be a buffer time where employers have to have this window to allow the employee to come back?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, right now there's nothing that I'm aware of that is going to actually extend the time that's currently in statute, which I believe is 60 days after you're released from active duty. That was changed again, I think, in 07 or 05. I can't remember, to extend that out. What is in right now is a House Joint Memorial, I believe it is, that's going to go to the Congress, and what we're asking for is, quote-unquote, the soft landing. And the soft landing being the 90 days that these folks could remain on federal active duty, paid for by the feds, to start this reintegration process. Right now, and we've heard testimony, or the Veterans Committee has heard testimony about this particular joint memorial. It's working its way through the legislature. It's going to get its opportunity, I'm sure, for all of you to vote on. We're very, very high on that, if we can move that forward. It's up to the Congress to make that decision. We believe, what we know from our people coming back right now, is in the reintegration process that there is a certain number of them, and I will just guess maybe 10 or 15 or 20% of them that probably can just, you know, change hats, go back to work the next day. We get 7 days after they hit Fort Lewis, and they've got to be released, which some of them can do that. There are a few that manage that. The state law protects them, I believe, for another 60 days, if I'm not mistaken, that they don't have to return to their job. Is that 60 or 30?
There are three windows, and by USERRA law, the first one, if they're in service from 1 to 30 days, they have to return the next working day. If it's 31 to 180 days, they have to return to work or apply to return to work within 14 days. Anything over 181 days, they have 90 days to reapply. These are handouts we give to employers, and soldiers will pass these out if you like.
So there are some built-in windows, both in the state statute and, of course, the federal laws for that period. What we're hoping to get is this soft landing paid for by the feds, we administer it here in the state of Oregon, as we do now. All of our soldiers, unless they're on state active duty for fires, floods, or anything else, are paid for by the feds under U.S. Code Title 32. And Title 32 allows the governor to be basically in charge, but use the federal money. And if we can convince Congress and get our delegation, which has indicated their support, to provide some or all of that, then those folks that absolutely got to have that longer period of time to readjust, they will stand a better chance, I think, of making that readjustment, as the General Docker indicated. The difference is that they can take the time now, but they don't get paid. And we're trying to keep that in there so folks will have a paycheck, be able to stabilize, be able to get back into the flow. I think I mentioned in the veterans hearing right now, we're looking at over 30% of the people that are deploying in May are unemployed, going out the door. So when you have that kind of unemployment rate going out, you know that you're going to have significant issues on the back end of trying to get these folks in the workforce in a meaningful or back to education, some means. So we're really, really pushing on this. I think there's national interest in a soft landing legislation, and we're hopeful that it will it will get enacted so we can deal with that. It makes no logical sense that you would give a person 7 days and say you've been, you know, 7 to 10 days ago you were getting shot at, now go back and do what your other job was. I mean, that just doesn't even make, it doesn't pass a common sense test. So we're hoping that the Congress will see fit to do that. I'll mention one other thing and then I'll turn it over to General Doctor. When we first learned, starting to learn how to deal with reintegration, was in 2004 after the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, was in Iraq, and they sustained, I think it was 10, 11 casualties. A lot of other wounded individuals that were back in some form of rehabilitation. We knew then when they left, almost 40% of that battalion, which is around 650 people, were unemployed when they left Oregon. Out of that 40%, we really recognize that one of the great things we should do is get employers to, you know, get them jobs as quick as we could. We had great support from the community, and I mean every single business you can imagine, from the most mundane type of business to the most complicated business, they showed up. We performed a job fair the last day of their active duty time that we had to reintegrate them, which I think we had 4 days with that group. We put up a job fair right down the street here in at the Anderson Readiness Center on State Street. I think we had something on the neighborhood, and Bob could probably correct me, Bob Elliott, around 40 or 50 employers. Every one of the employers said, we'll hire right on the spot. We brought every single one of the people that identified themselves as being unemployed, said, you will go through this station. And they said, yeah, they comply, yes, sir. They brought their families, their wives. They'd had all the other stuff. They went through it at the end of the night. We collected all the employers. So, well, how did it go? And they said, it went great. It was great. We just had a wonderful time. We're glad we're here. And how many people did you hire? And nobody hired a single person. Not one solitary job was hired. And I said, well, I thought you guys were offering jobs. I said, we worked. We'd have hired them on the spot. But nobody took the offer. And then it dawned on us that you cannot bring a soldier out of a combat zone 7 days later and say, you're home, take the job. Made absolutely no logical sense. We thought, what the hell were we thinking of? Yeah. You know, must have rocks in our head.
Yeah.
And so we've changed our style. We've changed the way we do business. We try to wait 3, 6, 9 months later. We start doing these job fairs more regionally than specific to a unit, so we can assess these people better and say, okay, who doesn't have a job now? 3 months later, 60 days later, whatever the case may be. And now we've seen we've got 180-some, 90 employers that are constantly on our list that are offering positions, and we're working it every day with our reintegration team to get these people hired on a daily basis, plus the job fairs that we're having around the state, and we're getting a lot better results. But it was a real eye-opener for us and something we had to learn on how do you deal with soldiers when they come back from combat, because we didn't understand that at that point in time. We were very disappointed initially. We thought, you know, what the hell's the matter with these people? You know, here we are offering all this goodwill and all that, and they just simply weren't ready. They couldn't mentally make that leap into that position. So, like I said, I firmly believe that the best support we have is from the business community, is from the employers in this state, and I think, by and large, we're talking about a very, very small bunch of people who do not get it, and they're very rare in this state, particularly after 5 years of this type of activity. I think we've seen great efforts on their parts, and I do believe that if we got a problem, it's most generally in the public sector. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very, very much. Additional questions or comments for General Caldwell? Mike, thank you very much. General Doctor.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Huffman, nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
I'm delighted to be here to discuss my favorite subject, the employer support of the Guard and Reserve. I'm Bill Doctor, the state chairman. That's an appointed position by the national director of the ESGR and also the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs. There are 56 committees throughout the nation. They cover the 50 states and the territories and possessions, and we have two in California because of the Guard and Reserve population down there. We have a hand-in-hand relationship with vets, and I want to introduce the folks that are here today very quickly. Our executive director, our full-time executive director, currently retired Bob Elliott. To his right is Mark Jorgensen, our outreach manager, who has touched literally hundreds of employers over the last 2 years, and Mr. Ron Cannon, director of USDOL Vets. And I'll get to that in just a second. ESGR was formed in 1972. If you recall, the draft was abolished in 1973. I like to think that those in Congress had the foresight to create an organization like this, knowing that the Strategic Reserve or the Guard Reserve would soon fill in case we had the big war with Russia at that time. So they created a volunteer organization to go out and be evangelical about the USERRA law. That's why it was created. Its roots go all the way back to 1940 with the Veterans' Rehire Right of 1940 when they activated the Guard back then. And no, I was not activated back then. We have two core competencies. The first is outreach, and that's really, I would say, the hardest one. Our outreach is to both employers and to the members of the National Guard and Reserve, and I always throw in their families, too, because they have a key interest in this. So we attempt to do outreach to every employer and then all the members of the Guard Reserve within our state. The other key issue is our ombudsman services. These folks are trained and certified in USERRA law. We like to say that we're the white hats. We will go out to the employers and explain the USERRA law. And hopefully the employer will say, boy, I had no idea. Just like Mike mentioned earlier, I had no idea. Not a problem. The problem ceased to exist. If that is, does not resolve the issue, there are other options. We cannot recommend anything to the soldier. And when I say soldier, it's soldier, sailor, airman, and marine. The next step is we turn over the case to U.S. DOL vets. And I'll get back to what was said earlier about state agencies. Anecdotally, I agree with Mike. I was quite astonished that, as I like to say, one of us, our soldiers had issues with them. I say anecdotally, we do not keep that anymore. The Administrative Disputes Resolution Act prevents any giveaway of any sensitive information on any kind of a case now. So we only know numbers. We absolutely don't know the employer. The other thing I will mention is we mediate through ombudsman services. We do outreach, but we have no enforcement arm. That's at that point, all we can say to the employer is, this is how we read it. If you have an issue, you need to take it someplace else. And we go to DOL vets. As I said, Oregon is a great state. We just came back from a regional conference, and when we go to national conferences, Oregon really looks quite good. I mentioned the 117 down to 21 and 17 resolved cases, which four going to DOL. I want to mention that USERRA gives primary protections to the Guard Reserve, but it also gives protections to the employer. The 1994 version of USERRA does give the employer a couple of protections. So I always like to, when I'm briefing employers, that say you too are covered under USERRA. When we mediate cases, we mediate the law. We do not take the soldier side. We do not take the employer side. We mediate for the law. And it's very important that we make that statement. And I'll just close by saying that we are delighted to be volunteers here. We have 80 on our committee throughout all of Oregon in 8 different areas, and outreach is our biggest issue. And I would just make a comment on the law. Outreach still needs to be in effect, and with volunteers, I'm not sure how you're going to handle that. But just the publishing of a law is not going to have that employer read it. So. We'll put that in our quiver of things we need to brief folks. But thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, General Doctor. Questions or comments for him?
Chair, I have a couple of questions just around, you know, first of all, the volunteers who are working with the program. So who are these people? Who becomes a volunteer?
They are primarily retired military. And but anyone can join the committee. We have retired attorneys on the committee. We have school administrators on the committee. We have former businessmen on the committee. Very briefly, USERRA was formed initially to brief the military, the National Guard and Reserve. Therefore, when the committees were created, it was very natural to get retired military on the committee, and they raised their hand readily. Now, because a significant portion of our outreach is to employers, we are making every attempt to balance that on the face of the committee. Mm-hmm. So, did that answer?
Yeah, and if I could follow up.
Please.
First of all, I think it's really a great program. And, you know, I share the chair's comment that, you know, most employers are doing the right thing, right? And maybe we, as a society, are not recognizing that as much as we should, you know. And I think that, you know, I noticed on the card that, you know, the first checkoff is recognition. And, you know, having the volunteers thank the employers for this. And it's not just the employers, it's also the coworkers, right, who in many cases are, you know, carrying the load and being a sort of support system for the soldiers who are fighting for them. And, you know, I think that the more that that can be recognized and, you know, the more this can be seen as a sort of team operation, you know, at home, in the field, you know, I think the easier the reintegration will be.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful segue. I left it out in a matter of time. We have a robust awards program. Starting with the statement of support, I just was fortunate enough, Mark Jorgensen did all of the heavy lifting with the Trailblazers, and at halftime I presented the president of the Trailblazers with the Employer Support of the Guard Reserve statement of support. The next award is the Patriot Award that the soldier himself or herself has to initiate. And we go out with the soldier and hopefully in front of the coworkers, make a nice presentation to the employer. We then, the committee, takes all of the Patriot Awards and take a look and take a look at the cream rising to the top, and then we divide them into two stacks, above and beyond, or the Pro Patria Award. Pro Patria Award is the highest award that the chairman can give. The highest award is the Freedom Award, given by the Secretary of Defense, and we put forward three employers this year. They're in competition right now, and it'll be decided soon as to which 10, or which, excuse me, which 15 employers throughout the nation will be invited back to Washington, D.C. Thank you. Okay,
thank you. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was sitting here, and Bill, as you said, you know, we just need to get the word out. It's one thing to create a new statute, but it's another to get the word out. And for myself, and I know all of us probably do weekly radio call-ins into our area, and I was sitting here thinking, you know, this is a topic that I will cover on one of my radio shows in a friendly way of reminding employers out there that, you know, this is the law, and now we're in the process of passing another law to put a friendly reminder in, you know, that this is our obligation to our returning veterans as a part of reintegration. Mike, I'm assuming the National Guard still has the NCSA campaign relationship with the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and, you know, that might be a place to add an ad into the mix that runs throughout the state as just a friendly reminder to employers that this is the law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, we do indeed have that relationship, and the National ESGR office does a very, very good job of putting out this type of information as well, and I have seen, and I'm sure you have too, ads run for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve in many venues, particularly on TV and on the radio. But I will emphasize that with our advertising group, because I think that is important, particularly if the legislature does pass this statute, because again, I think we're talking about a very small number of people. It just seems that way. Anecdotally, as General Docker indicated, I probably see two or three a year that actually come across my desk. Usually I call Colonel Elliott. He's already got them. He's already aware of them. And they've already been bubbling up somewhere in the system. But there just aren't that many that are really that egregious that come up that really have to be dealt with. But when they happen, as David indicated, usually the individual that's been having the problem is least able to take care of themselves with respect to, you know, having an income, having issues to go get an attorney, to do the different things that they really need to do to protect themselves. And those are the ones that really stick in your craw. We had another one that was a guardsman who was deployed. He actually ended up being deployed, I think, for 24 months because of his particular specialty. He came back to Oregon, worked for a public body again. They had eliminated the position. He was basically a supervisor of the school buses and this sort of thing, and they, as a cost-cutting measure, had gone to a private contractor. He basically, there was nothing anybody could do to help him with respect to going back and getting the job. Through ESGR, we were able to try to get him into the new system. We ended up, basically, the thing just was going so south so badly and had been so long and so aggrieved, we found a spot for him and hired him full-time for us. Because it just, I mean, this it was one of those rare cases that the guy did everything right. His employer didn't do anything wrong. They did exactly what they were forced to do because of economics, but yet he was left holding the bag because he'd been off defending his country. So those kind of things happen occasionally, and there's, you know, really no fault. It's just the way things happen. So we've got to be able to step up and find other ways to get this person employed in a meaningful place. So we do work. We work those EACHs very aggressively, and unfortunately, sometimes we don't know about them because in this particular case, he was a bit ashamed, actually, and he was not willing to come out and tell his command, you know, I've got a real problem. And then finally, his wife ran into somebody in our family program and just literally broke down because they had no money. They had no way to pay for what they were doing. Their kids were in high school, and she just fell apart. And I got a call, and I said, what's going on, you know? And so those things happen. So no matter how much law you write, you're going to have something come out that you just got to find other workarounds. And we're willing to do that. We're willing to do anything we can. And again, our Oregon employers, I think, have been incredibly generous and aggressive trying to hire our people.
Might I respond to the vice chair? I can't pass up this opportunity, but with two things. We are just now creating a 30-second and a 90-second PSA through our public affairs director, and that'll be out on the streets hopefully by the end of April. Also, if you would like the service of myself, Bob Elliott, or Mark Jorgensen, to assist you with ESGR issues, but we'd love to do it at any time, anywhere.
Well, I know that Bill Johnstone is always
you bet.
Open door.
You bet.
I'll put him on your radio show at 6 a.m. in the morning.
I'm retired. It's okay.
We actually, Vice Chair Huffman's suggestion actually has given me a couple of ideas, and I think I'm going to suggest it to a couple of radio stations in my district that they invite you gentlemen or some of your representatives to come on the radio show. A lot of the stations, particularly the rural ones, are looking for guest appearances, guest commentators, and I just think this would be a fantastic opportunity.
If I could just add one other thing, it was Representative Dimbrough brought up the makeup of this committee. In Oregon, as was mentioned, we don't have an active duty base, so all of these folks that are on there are citizen soldiers. They may be retired, but they also had the majority of their life in butcher, baker, candlestick maker, you know, in our community. So they're, it's not like we're, you know, I know a lot of people look at retired military, well, they spent their whole life, 30 years, doing that one thing, and they really don't get at what's going on in the community. We are the community. That's where we draw our people. That's who represents us in all walks of life with the Guard and Reserve.
Very good. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, General Caldwell just gave me my segue. I just wanted to thank all of you for what you do and, you know, making a huge, huge effort that's heartfelt at providing services for people coming back in the Guard and Reserve. But in addition to that, you know, I know this program's primarily focused on the Guard and Reserve, and of course I declare a conflict of interest here, but I do know we don't have an active duty base in Oregon, and I just want to make sure that we don't ever forget that we do have regular military people that do come back to this state as well, and they're a little bit harder to find because we don't have that active duty base here. We're focused mainly on the Guard and Reserves.
and I know you all know that, and probably have lots of outreach programs to address those veterans too. They're ultimately important too, and I hope they don't slip through the cracks in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawley, just a subtle comment on that. One of the things that we found with our reintegration, and we weren't, again, we started building this bike while we were riding it, so we really didn't know what we didn't know. And what we found and became, and I think it would be echoed by the ESGR folks, is that we have become that active. We're Fort Oregon now, and the Oregon Guard is basically the only one with the resources to do the things that need to be done for retired military, for returning veterans. We've linked up tightly with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. You know, we share information. We're talking constantly. We're serving on different committees together. And part of this reintegration process in the summit is the word's gone out to the non-governmental agencies, organizations, to get people to come to Fort Oregon, to the Oregon National Guard, to get their ID cards, to work through their issues. As just an example, one segment of this building we built down here on State Street, which was just cavernous when we built it, we thought, my God, look at all this space. We've got places for everything. And now we don't have enough space because we've gone in some sections, one in particular, went from 3 people to 40 just to handle the mobilizations and the reintegration. And part of that process now, we've got, of course, our healthcare operation going in there. We didn't used to have one of those. We've got 3 people working in there now. That's all they do is TRICARE and the TRICARE issues. So we see a tremendous flow across our door of airmen, Marines, sailors, Coast Guardsmen, you name it. They're coming to us. And that's been a shift for us, but certainly it's kind of an all-services deal right now. And we've learned to do that, I think, very effectively, and it's working out. I think we've gotten great comments from active duty people, former active duty people, and veterans. And again, we're not the experts in every area, but part of this discovery has been we've found out who they are, so we can direct people now. We can get them to the right spot. Whereas before, we said, well, you're not in the Guard. Go find your whatever your element is. You're not us. Go away. And we don't do that. We don't do that at all. We're an open door.
It's good to hear. Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Bill, one of my staff members, Irv Fletcher, is the chair of the Veterans Advisory Committee. I'm going to put him on call on the radio stations. So if you hear from a radio station or from Irv, you know where it's coming from. Before I let everybody go, Mike told us about how he helped save a veteran's family here recently. And I just, I'm going to embarrass him. I always do, but I just want to recognize the efforts that he and his troops did in my district back a couple of years ago when half my district was underwater, and he had massive deployments out there, and they were plucking people out of buildings in boats. They were setting up tent communities all over the district. They were feeding meals, taking care of people who were sick and injured, and God knows what else. I mean, he had every single personnel member that he could possibly scrape together out there. He's now received about 10 calls from me. Help on this, help on that, help on everything else. Last thing he needs is another call from me. Mike, I need another generator up in Vernonia. He goes, I've checked all the way to Idaho. There isn't anything left. When we locate one, we'll see what we can do. Next afternoon, there was a generator in Vernonia. Mike, thank you so much. You're a can-do operation, and I want to thank this panel, each and every one of you, for the great job that you do for the veterans of this state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to call up now, please, Colonel Elliott and Bob Estabrook, please. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to our subcommittee.
Good morning. Thank you. I'll go first.
I'm happy to.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Estabrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. You have some written testimony from us, and I apologize that it doesn't bear into account the Dash 1 amendments to the bill, which I didn't realize were around until just this morning when I arrived. But I don't think that they really change what Bowley would like to get on the record. Really, I think just two things. One, that as the primary enforcement agency for state labor and employment law, I think that Bowley is going to be at the forefront of the effort on 3256. We support the bill. We're happy to do the work. I think that the expertise that we have from enforcing all of the other unlawful employment practices laws, also enforcing veterans' preference related to some of the same folks that we're talking about in 3256, those are duties that Bowley already has, and we're more than happy to have the support of the Department of Justice in working with these folks and making sure that they get the protection that they deserve. The other thing that I want to highlight, which is not really in my written testimony, but our Technical Assistance for Employers unit, when we talk about outreach and getting folks to comply with the law, most folks want to do the right thing. Really the way that they get an understanding of what the right thing to do is and how they're supposed to comply with the law is through those technical assistance services that our TA unit provides. It's a free service, so it's something that, you know, even small employers are able to utilize and avoid having to go into a full-blown investigation or go to the level of some kind of civil court action. So really, Bowley is, like I say, at the forefront of dealing with these issues, trying to get them resolved as quickly and efficiently as possible without ever going to the level of a DOJ investigation or something like that. That's really all that I wanted to highlight. I think that the testimony you heard earlier is correct, that we do have a good working relationship with the Department of Justice. Generally speaking, we're the ones who get to deal with things first and more of them, but does not in any way compromise our ability to work well with those folks. So I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments at this point? I'm not seeing any. Colonel.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Colonel Bob Elliott. I live in Salem, Oregon. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon ESGR Committee. I'm a paid professional along with Mark Jorgensen, and I have one other assistant, and the rest of my committee is all strictly volunteers. So thank you. Just a couple items. I had a chance to sit in the back and line out items that Bill Doctor brought up, and a couple things that he didn't get to bring up I thought that might be of interest to you. First of all, Paul Evans would be here today, but he's on furlough, and he's serving his country today at the Camp Riley. And so he's wanted me to make sure that you knew that he was interested in this. The PSAs that Bill Doctor talked about are being produced locally by one of our volunteers who works for the Department of Veterans as a public affairs person for them. And KXL Radio Network throughout the state has volunteered to cover those. So we are on top of that. It's just trying to get it all together. It's a timing event. As you know, the brigade is mobilizing for training 1st of April, 1st of May. They will be moving out. So we are going to be prepared to run those PSAs when they start to leave. And we'll do it in a stage throughout the year and updated when they're coming back a year from now. We got some more PSAs, and we got a commitment out of that station, that network anyway, for the year. So we feel good for that, but it's an ongoing event also, but we do have some coverage on the media part. Currently, the 41st Brigade has 20, we've interviewed 2,700 people. Some of them aren't going to go, but most of them are. And the reason I want to let you know that is for details in the Medford area, Representative, you have 222 in the Southern Oregon, and in the city of Medford, you have 93. And we've had the chance, I have the details here, to for everybody that has a question. And in your area, I just looked, I apologize, I know you are from the Astoria, Vernonia, that area. Astoria has 3, for an example. So I have it down by name, by person, the numbers of every community. So if you want that information, we can provide that to you. First time we had the opportunity to do that, and we don't have a Social Security number, so we can deal with the information and not the Privacy Act. What we're doing with that is there's 10,000 total reservists in the state of Oregon, counting all the other reserves. The brigade is only sending, about 2,500. We have 364th Reserve out of Portland, from throughout the entire state that are gone right now. So basically you have 3,000 constituents that are out right now.
The awards program, our goal is to do 100 this year, and we're already at 75, so we're halfway through, so we hope to get more. With the mobilization, once they go, and I'm going to give you those numbers in a moment, we think the awards program will expand this next year. The fact that they do leave, and when they're deployed and they're coming back, so our program is just not this 6 months. It's the year and a half to 2 years. The incidents with Ron Cannon and myself, we and our ombudsman, there is no violation of the law until they come back. So it's education between now and then. And then when they do come back, that's where we'll see some of the issues. So we hope the bill can get going and we can get the teeth into it and get the education process going. How we do the education process? We work with BOLI. We've been there 3 years, Bill? I think we've been up to 2 years. We've been at the BOLI conference and we have a session there. And also SHRM, the professional HR people in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. They flip-flop between Oregon and Washington where they hold it. We've been there for 7 years. This next year, we're actually going to be on the agenda and get to speak. So that's a breakthrough for us. So we do the education piece, and we work quite well with BOLI and other state agencies. One example I wanted to give you, though, let me go to the numbers real quick. We have a total of, as I said, 2,700. 1,587 or 58% are employed. 919 are unemployed, which is 33%. And we have 207 that are students. That's 7%. And a few odds and ends. So the returning, the unemployed, I talked to most of those. And Mark, myself, and Don, the professionals, were at every event. And most of those young unemployed are looking forward to going back to school. So what the state of Oregon is going to do in the military department is we have a Diane Beach, who is our education officer. She'll be there representing all the schools. We hope to get them into school. So that's where a lot of those unemployed are. And then Jim Booker from the Department of Employment will be there with his staff to help educate job resumes on the state side. And then also what General Caldwell's always talked about is we do have the reintegration team that's prepared to do the same thing with our CTAP program, which we have some individuals to help. So we're prepared. We've been doing this for 7 years. We're just perfecting it. And now the test comes because we're going to have this large amount going. Just a few examples, and then I'll sum up, is as you're aware, former Chief of Police of Sherwood, Warrant Officer Middleton, is no longer with the city. I talked to him last night. He'd like to have been here today, but he has business down in Vegas with his daughter for school. I also have an individual, I won't use state his name, but the individual called me a week ago, gave his 2 weeks notice that he was to his boss that he was getting deployed from Central Oregon, and he was laid off. Our ombudsman called, and the employer, he was given a check for the days missed. He's back at work. He's doing the right thing, giving the 2 weeks notice. The employer, it's easy to let people go now during these economic times when they're leaving. So that's an example. It's going on day in, day out. It just happened to have one. Got another one, the United States Air Force. Sent a letter. The government sent a letter to us, not to me, but to the command. It said, you can't let this lieutenant go. He's too critical for our mission. And the company, the battalion commander from Central Oregon called up, the Air Force and said, he's critical for our mission. We need him. He's a lieutenant. We need him. We need frontline supervisors. So it's not just you. It's not the state of Oregon. It's not the public. It's the United States government also. The reason I bring that up is we're going to get busier in the next 3 or 4 months as people leave their employment and their spouses here, there's issues. Again, as Ron Cannon says, there's no violation until they come back. But we're going to try to do that part to fix that. I do have an example of one here in my letter. Again, I will not say his name. He works for a fire department. There is a state issue, and I'll bring it up with the Department of Justice. But the state of Washington, for example, lets their firefighters have 15 days of firefighting duty. We are entitled to that. But if you... The state of Oregon, the way it works, and I don't have all the details, but when he wrote on his little note to me, it says when he takes a weekend drill, his shift works is that weekend. He's on for like 48 hours and he gets 3 days off. He basically loses basically all of his 15 days because of the way they work it. So he doesn't get 15 days. So we do have some other issues we need to work on, some small things. So there's issues all over the place. I hope they get to come out and we get them resolved. What we would like to see is the
State AG's office form an ombudsman program where we can take the city, county, state, and any PERS participant that has an issue, and we can take the issue from our ombudsman to their ombudsman and let them drive the train downhill instead of trying to push the rope uphill. So we also would like to let you know that we're available at any time to answer any questions and work with the committee for anything you might need. And are there any questions?
Colonel, thank you very, very much. Questions or comments?
Thank you for your time.
We certainly appreciate your time, too, and all of the very great and very good work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mostly it's by my committee of volunteers, though.
Thank you. Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
That completes the witness sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 3256 before we close the public hearing? Last and final call. Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3256, and I'm going to open a work session on the same bill. All right. Subcommittee members, first of all, Representative Matthews, would you come up just for a very brief second here? We have before us a Dash 1 amendment, and Representative Matthews, this is an amendment I'm presuming that that you support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, and that's correct, Mr. Chair. That's an amendment that was being worked on with the Department of Justice. So I've talked with Colonel Kramer about that particular amendment, and we're in support of that.
Okay, sounds very good. Any of the subcommittee members have questions about the Dash 1 amendment while we have the representative here? In that instance, I will entertain a motion. Dash 1 amendment. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 appendage to House Bill 3256.
Representative Esquivel moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3256. Discussions on the motion? Seeing none, hearing none. Is there any opposition to the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3256? I am seeing none and hearing none. They're so adopted. On the bill, to the referral to the committee. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 3256 as amended with appendage 1 to Business and Labor Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3256 as amended to the full committee on Business and Labor. Discussion on that motion? I'm not seeing any. Are there any questions? I'm not seeing any of those either, not hearing any. Is there any objection to sending House Bill 3256 as amended to the full committee? It's out of here. Okay.
All in one meeting.
With that, I am going to close the work session on House Bill 3256. Kevin, do we have coming events?
Excuse me, members of the committee, Chairman Witt. First of all, with respect to the 3256, as soon as I find out the day, and this will apply as well to 2732, I believe, the little task force that could, as soon as I get that information for the non-members of the Business and Labor Committee, I will let you know. I'm hearing rumors that perhaps the big committee wouldn't mind either hearing and or seeing on the day that that bill comes up. Probably the same thing with this. I will advise you again as we're working out the schedule. We will not be having a hearing on Tuesday. However, on Thursday we will be scheduling House Bill 2398 to begin moving forward with hopefully getting that worked out with the final amendments to that bill, and so that's kind of what's set on the agenda. There may be additional bills as we get into crunch time from the big committee, but we're kind of letting them set their schedule, and then we will, I guess, react as necessary. So,
great. Anything for the good of the order? Not seeing anything. We stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone, very much.